If you've been with us for the last few weeks, you know that we're in a series from the opening chapters of the book of Revelation. We're looking at the seven letters that Jesus sent to seven churches a couple thousand years ago. And some people may say, well, why in the world would you be looking at letters to somebody else? They aren't letters to me. I've got enough going on in my world. Why do I need to read someone else's mail? Well, reason we're looking at these letters, quite frankly, is because the messages that Jesus sent to those churches are just as relevant to us as they were to them. They're seven letters that are filled with insight into how God wants us to live. And probably one of the biggest things that I'd want you to take if you wrestle with why should we look at this passage, it's this. I am convinced that the way we see Jesus shapes the way we live out our faith. You've heard me say that before over the last couple of weeks. The way we see Jesus shapes the way we live out our faith. If we see Jesus only as a baby in a manger, we might be tempted to treat him like other Christmas decorations. We pull him out at the right time of year, and then we put him away because we don't need him. We'll take him out again if we need him, but we'll put him away again if we don't need him. Or if you see Jesus only as a man who's hanging on a cross, you just might be tempted to forget that he rose victorious from the grave, conquering sin, death, and hell. And you might forget that he has the power to transform your life and bring life to your life. The way we see Jesus shapes the way we live out our faith. I believe that's true throughout any of the writings of the Apostle John. I said last week that if you read through the Gospels, you'll find each chapter contains at least one word picture of who Jesus is. I am the living water. I am the bread of life. Those kind of images. And now in Revelation chapter 1, as we saw a couple weeks ago, there was another picture of Jesus. Do you remember it? Jesus was the one standing in the middle of the lampstands which represented the churches of his day. He was the one of great power and wisdom who held the whole world in his hand. He is Jesus. If you like word pictures, you'll like the seven letters because each one of them also starts with another word picture of who Jesus is. Each one of them, we're going to see one this morning as we look at the second letter, the one written to a church of Smyrna. If you have a Bible, turn to Revelation 2 with me. If you don't, words are going to be on the screen in a moment. Before we get into it, though, I feel like I need to not make a confession or a disclaimer, but be honest about something. A couple years ago, during what was probably one of the darkest periods in my own journey in ministry, one of the hardest, brutal times I've gone through, a time I don't ever want to go through again, I decided to do a study on stress in Scripture. I've read books, both secular and sacred. I've been to seminars, secular and sacred. But I wanted to do a study of how biblical characters handled stress. So I started looking at the stories of men like Elijah and Daniel, John, Paul. And in the midst of it all, I learned some different insights on how to view my own stress and my own strain. And a couple of years ago, I shared with you from the passage we're going to look at this morning, because it was one that God spoke to me powerfully through. And so this morning, if you, as we're reading it, say, hey, I've heard this before. Well, I'm hoping you haven't had it heard at all, because it's not the same sermon. But there might be some words that you go, I've heard this. You have. I can even give you the date when you heard it if you're really interested, because it's part of the journey. But I've found this time, as I'm reading through this letter again, there's other things I didn't see last time that God's showing me, and I'm praying it'll be a blessing to you. Smyrna, I showed you on the map, there's a little arrow. If you go back there one slide, that'd be cool. It's about 25, 35 miles north of Ephesus, the church we looked at last year. It was a city that was known for its harbor. It was a harbor through which they controlled trade. It's a harbor which meant not only money, but power. It was a special place. It was considered one of the most beautiful cities in the day. I have a feeling you guys may have visited the modern-day Smyrna. It's still a city that exists, Izmir, Turkey. Alexander the Great referred to it as a model Greek city, a place that was known for culture, art, philosophy, religion flourished there, Smyrna. From a Christian perspective, there was something else that stood out about Smyrna. Smyrna was a place known for martyrdom. It was a place where more Christians lost their lives because of their faith than anywhere else in the region. One historian said it this way: the Church of Smyrna has come to represent the martyrs of all time and the sweet-smelling fragrance of their devotion until death. Smyrna. Well, that's the context, that's the setting, if you will, to which Jesus spoke these words. So follow along, beginning verse 8. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of him who is the first and the last. First and the last. Smyrna was a city engaged in a long-standing rivalry with their neighbors, Ephesus, over the title First City of Asia. It was a title you wanted because it was more than like the Calgary-Edmonton, you know, sports rivalry thing. This was one that represented power. If you were declared to be the first city in the eyes of the Romans, it meant you were given the right to build a temple. And if you built a temple, guess what happened? People came. You grew in influence, you grew in power, you grew in size, you grew in population. We're number one was their constant battle, so much so that in Smyrna they actually stamped that on their coins. First in size and beauty in Asia. That's what their coin said. We want to be number one. How does Jesus introduce himself? I'm the first. I'm the last. You who think you're number one, think again. Not only will I have the first word, I will have the last word. Listen up. I'm the first and the last. Notice what comes next. Who died and came to life again. Those words had to have struck a chord on at least two levels. Firstly, the city of Smyrna had gone through several deaths and rebirths. It's referred to as a phoenix city. It had been destroyed a number of different times. One of the ones who rebuilt it was Alexander the Great. It seemed to keep coming back to life again. That would have caught their ear, don't you think? I'm the one who died, but has come back to life. It also would have touched a chord for those who lost loved ones to martyrdom. Those who'd been so set on their faith, confident that Jesus would fulfill that promise that they would be resurrected. He said, I'm the one. I'm the one. Colossians 1:18 refers to Jesus as the firstborn from among the dead. The words of the first, the last, who died, who came back to life. Next word, I know. I know. I know. Those words you hear a lot in our world, don't you? Thanks to gadgets like these, people who don't know much can know a lot. A couple years ago, Lori and I were overseas somewhere, and she got a text on a device like this that said, our dryer just died at home. Two of my sons were home. And you know what they did? They Googled it. They found out what was wrong. They found the part that they needed. They found the supplier that they could get the part from. And then they watched a YouTube video on how to fix it. And the next text we got was, dryer's fixed. And I went, I didn't know the dryer was broken. What do you mean fixed? They can honestly say, we know how to fix a dryer, thanks to a device. We know. But do we really know as much as we think we know? We know we have opinions. Someone once said that opinions are like a belly button. Everyone has one. We have opinions. And we like to think our opinions are, which ones, the right ones or the wrong ones? The right ones, of course, because we know. about everything we know. Jesus says, I know. I know. Maybe I look at it from a different angle. Have you ever had someone come up to you and say, I know exactly how you feel? How does that make you feel on the inside? No, you don't. I've watched people who are at a funeral going through the loss of a loved one, and someone comes alongside and says, I know how you feel. And they mean well, but they don't. Because they don't know your relationship with the person you just lost. You may think you know, or you may kind of know, but notice Jesus doesn't use any of those fillers. He says, I know. I know. When Jesus says, I know, he means it. He knows everything that's going on in our world. He doesn't have to Google it. He knows exactly how we feel. He knows exactly what it's like to go through the struggles we go through in life. Hebrews 2:18 says that because Jesus suffered when he was tempted, he's able to help those who are being tempted. He knows what it's like to feel tempted. Two chapters later, it says, we do not have a high priest who's unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who's been tempted in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin. Jesus knows. If you're ever tempted to say, no one knows how hard it is to live the life I live, read this passage. Read those two words. He knows. Your neighbor may not. That kind-hearted person who just came along and put their arm around your shoulder and said, I know how you feel, may not. But there's one who does. He knows. Notice what he knows. Next word. I know your afflictions. Some translations capture it as tribulations. Either way, it comes from a word, this is the one you might remember from a couple years ago, thlipsis. Love that word, thlipsis. Hard to say. I know your afflictions and your tribulations. The word thlipsis means crushing pressure. And it comes from two word pictures. One of them was associated to a mode of execution. If a convicted killer refused to admit his guilt, he was placed in a position where a giant boulder would be rolled across his chest, literally crushing the life out of him. Thlipsis. The other word picture is associated with the word Gethsemane. Remember that word? It was not only a garden where Jesus went to pray, the Garden of Gethsemane. You might recall that the garden was located at the base of the Mount of Olives. Looking at her all right. Base of the Mount of Olives. A place that was known for having an olive press. Olives would be collected, and after they had been ground in under a giant stone wheel, they'd be put in burlap bags, placed on a platform, and then this large, massive stone pillar called a Gethsemane was lowered upon the bags to squash the oil out of what remained. Oil was then collected and sold and used for various purposes. Crushing pressure. Quite the picture, isn't it? I know the crushing pressure you live under. I know the burdens you bear. I know how heavy it feels. I've been there. I know what that's like. I know your pain. I know that it feels like it's squishing the life out of you. I know. I know your afflictions. What else? I know your poverty. Two words Jesus could have used for poverty. One of them basically said you're scraping by. The other one said you're absolutely destitute. He chose the word destitute. If you were to think in terms of our way of thinking, if you had the two words, one would say you're barely making it from paycheck to paycheck, but you're making it. The other is, you're living out of a dumpster. That's the word Jesus chose. Now follow me on this. I know your poverty. Jesus is saying that when it comes to the situations you're facing in life, you don't have two nickels to your name. You cannot scrape together the resources required to handle the circumstances you're facing. I know your afflictions. I know what you got in the bank in terms of being able to handle all of those afflictions. You're living in poverty. You got nothing left. There was a financial perspective to it, but it was more than that. It was more about human resource. You don't have what it takes to handle all that you're facing. That picture in mind, notice what's next. It's strange. Yet you're rich. How's that possible? You're being crushed by the weight of all you're facing in life. You don't have the resources necessary to fight off what you're facing, yet you're rich. Only way that statement's possible is if you realize that Jesus is saying, you've got nothing except everything I bring to your life. The only thing you've got is me. And because you got me, you're rich. Because you got me. I know your afflictions and your poverty. I know all that you're facing in life. But don't forget, you've got me. You've got me. Carry on. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Man, I wish verse 10 started differently. I know all about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan, so I'm going to airlift you out of that situation. I know all that's going on around you. I know they're a synagogue of Satan, so I'm going to silence their mouths. I'm going to bind their hands. I'm going to make sure you don't have to face this anymore. I know all that you're facing, all the crushing pressure, I'm going to relieve it. It's not what verse 10 says. Do not fear what you're about to suffer. Why didn't God just rescue them? Why didn't he make the troubles go away? Were they being punished? Well, of all the seven churches that receive letters from Jesus, this was one of only two that doesn't get a rebuke. So they were on the right track. They had not left their first love. They were not lukewarm. They were not indifferent to falsehood. They were not compromising in terms of morality. They were passionate followers of Jesus, but still they faced pressure. And just to be really, really clear, when Bible translators search for an English substitute for thalipsis, the words they use are words like persecution, affliction, distress. All of them reference pressure placed not only on a person's body, but upon their heart, upon their soul. There is an unmistakable spiritual component to it. Thalipsis. It's physical, emotional, spiritual pressure that threatens to break us, crush us, squash us. I'm convinced it's the word Paul had in mind when he penned these words. We are hard pressed on every side, not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, not destroyed. We're under pressure. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that Domitian, the emperor who followed Nero, was profoundly insecure and desperate to remain in control of this particular part of the world. So he demanded that every citizen on an annual basis go to the temple, take a pinch of salt, throw it onto the altar, and declare Caesar's Lord. There was, however, an out clause, if you will, an exemption that was given to the Jews when it came to two things in life, in Roman-occupied territory. The first was they had an exemption for military service, and the second was an exemption for ceremonial sacrifice, a freedom not to go and put that pinch of salt on the temple, on the altar. But it was an exemption that everyone knew could be taken away at the drop of a hat. If you did anything to offend the Romans, well, you were going to the temple, either to sacrifice or to be executed. The Jews who had rejected Jesus saw this as a golden opportunity. If they played their cards right, they'd not only be able to avoid making that repulsive declaration of Caesar being Lord, they would also be able to get the Jesus-believing Jewish people in heaps of trouble. All they would have to do is spread rumors about Christ followers taking liberties. And the Romans would view it as an uprising, and they'd swoop in and squash them. And that happened in Smyrna. Their shops of believers were confiscated and ransacked because the Romans believed the false allegations. Some of them were thrown in jail in an attempt to intimidate others into obeying the emperor. Some were martyred for their faith. They lived under constant solipsis. Move to verse 10. As you do, one of the themes of the book of Revelation is captured in the word apocalypse, which means uncovering or an unveiling. It speaks to the idea that there's more going on beneath the surface than you and I might be aware of. We see the surface level, but there's something going on. And when there's an apocalypse, it means that God pulls back the veil and says, here's what you're missing. That appears in verse 10. Jesus says, the devil will put some of you in prison. I thought it was the Romans. Pull back the veil. There's something else going on beneath the surface. The devil will put some of you in prison to test you. You will suffer persecution for 10 days. Although the Romans, the Jews, the Christians, they're all clearly engaged in conflict, there was something else going on behind the scenes. Another battle that was raging, a battle between dark and light, the kingdom of this world and the kingdom of our God. A battle between Satan and our Savior. And that's the setting in which Jesus speaks these words, be faithful, even to the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt at all by the second death. An interesting passage. Where do you find hope when life seems utterly hopeless? Where do you turn? I think this letter offers a few suggestions, and they aren't mine. They're suggestions from Christ himself, the author of the letter. We can have hope no matter what the pressure is we're facing because, first, it doesn't last forever. There's a reference in verse 10 to you will suffer persecution for 10 days. And some say that is a number that refers to completion. Some say it's got other imagery associated with it. I'm not entirely sure. All I know is that if it says 10 days, then it has an ending. It doesn't say infinite days. 10 days. There will be a start, there will be an end. It's that way with the pressure we face in life. There's a start, and there will be an end. Tim Keller offers this perspective. We were not created for a world of death, for the loss of love, for a world of violence or loneliness. We must remember that. On this side of heaven, much of life will feel vain and pointless. So don't let the times of darkness completely overwhelm you. This world will not last forever. No matter what pressure you're facing, it will end. It's not forever. Second thought comes from verse 10. There is a purpose to pressure. It refines us. It proves and improves us, if you will. We may not like that, but that's what it does. The oft-quoted passage from James chapter 1 says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, when you face trials of many kinds." And if you're in the midst of trials, I got a sneaking suspicion that's right when you tune out. "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, when you face trials of many kinds." Yeah, okay. You clearly don't understand my trials. You clearly don't have a clue. But since there's more going on beneath the surface than you may currently see, listen to what comes next. The testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. There's more going on in the midst of your pressure than you may currently see. You're feeling overwhelmed by stress. There's more going on than you may currently see. It may feel horrible. It may feel crushing. But there's a purpose to it if you could just peel back the veil and see what's there. I don't like pain and pressure any more than anyone else. But I've found that God, who promises that he can use anything to accomplish his good, uses pain and pressure and stress like tools that are unlike any other tools. They're effective at dealing with issues in my life like nothing else on earth. They bring out the areas in me where God needs to continue to refine and shape and mold me like nothing else. Stress brings out my ugly side. Like nothing else on earth. So God can use it. Because when the ugliness is revealed and I see it, now I can ask him to do something about it. Let me frame it in a real practical way. Yesterday I was driving with Lori and I said, there's been a question that has been, I know God put it there and it's been there all week long. And I've tried to keep it in mind with every interaction I've had. Sometimes successfully, sometimes not so much. What if the person that I'm about to encounter showed up in church on Sunday and they recognized me? Think about that when you're driving down the street and someone cuts you off. What if they showed up in church on Sunday and they recognized you? What about that delivery person who just came to your door and you told them off because they were late and the package arrived and it was half ripped open and they need to do their job better? What if they showed up in church on Sunday and they recognized you? What if that person who served you dinner and you decided they didn't do a good enough job, and you said, I'm going to shortchange them on a tip. They don't deserve much. What if they showed up in church on Sunday and said, good morning, nice to see you? You see, those are the kind of practical daily, those are easy stress situations, but those are the stress situations that bring out an ugly side, don't they? When we feel that we've been ripped off, taken advantage of, spoken of poorly, what if we saw those as times when God could do something in us? Times that he could use in a very unique way to accomplish something that nothing else on earth will accomplish. Crushing pressure doesn't last forever. Crushing pressure has a way of refining us. One more thought. Crushing pressure comes with a promise. It's two of them in verses 10 and 11. Verse 10 speaks of a crown of life. Verse 11 says we won't be hurt by the second death. James 1:12 offers that same promise. It says, God blesses those who patiently endure testing and temptation. Afterward, they'll receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. Philipsis is painful. There's no getting around it. But it comes with a promise. It's not one you can secure for yourself. It's one only God can give, and he promises it to those who remain faithful. Crown of life, not taste the second death. I don't know what you're facing this morning. I'll take that back. I know what some of you are facing because you talked to me. I know some of you are under a giant, massive stone that feels like it's crushing the life out of you. I've met some people who are convinced that when that's the weight that they're feeling, that maybe God's mad at them. Well, if you're living in open rebellion to God, that might be a reasonable conclusion. But if your heart is set on seeking him, if you're walking in obedience to him, if it's your desire to honor him, if your moral compass is set to obedience instead of to rebellion, when life goes sideways, it probably isn't because God's mad at you. In fact, it might be a sign you're on the right track in some settings. The devil doesn't mess with those who are walking with him. He targets those who are walking with Christ. If you're growing in your walk with God, if you're helping others grow in their walk with God, the reality is you're going to be facing some pressure. You're going to face some opposition. Philipsis comes to those who are walking closer and closer with Christ. It's inevitable. It doesn't make it any more comfortable. It's still crushing pressure. If that's how you feel about your life right now, that you're walking with God, you're trying to do the right thing, and yet you're still feeling like there's a giant boulder being rolled upon your chest and it's crushing the life out of you, then I want to offer you this, and it's more than just a phrase. I want to remind you that Jesus is with you in the midst of whatever you're facing in life. The message that John said at the start of these letters in John chapter 1 was that Jesus was right in the middle of the lampstands, right with the people in these churches as he wrote these letters. Not only that, he's not only there, he knows. He knows exactly what you're facing. Even if no one else on earth does. He knows what you're facing. He knows why it's happening. He knows what he's going to accomplish out of it. He knows when it's going to end. And he's with you and promised to not leave you in the midst of it alone. So again, I don't know what everyone in the room's facing. I don't know how you're feeling about it. But I'd offer you this. The one who knows all is with y'all. He's with us all. And maybe that's what you needed to hear this morning. If it is, I invite you to call out to him. We're going to pray. And maybe you're a visual person who needs to act on something you're going to pray. Maybe you need to be reminded that Jesus is with you right in the middle of this, and you need to lift your hands and reach out to him and say, thank you that you're here with me. Maybe you're going to point your hands towards the cross. Maybe you're not a visual person and you're going to keep your hands in your pockets as we pray. That's fine. But if you're under pressure this morning, I encourage you to reach out to the one who knows your pressure, knows how to fix it, and is with you in the midst of it. So would you pray with me?